session number 11928, rule 8.
It's Rian Fraser, reel 8.
Well, just a brief one on the signal school. This bushfire broke out, and being a signal school, there were plenty of telegraphers about. And they sent us up to control the fire with handheld sets. There was only one thing wrong, that somebody had forgotten to recharge the batteries. They were the old dry cells. There were NICADs in those days. And we got cut off. And it was a very, very frightening experience. We managed to obviously get away with it. We sort of had somebody with the party that was a South African himself and knew his way around a little bit, and he just was able to send out the wind and decide which was the best way to go. But that was the sort of thing that happened. The batteries were actually, after about 5 minutes, they were flat. Well, then I got passage home on HMS Newcastle. The captain was absolutely bonkers. He was mad. The instructions are that no ship should paint, no commander should paint ship while proceeding at sea. And this chap had a gangplank over, and bloke's painting the side at 22 knots. It's just crazy, the whole thing. We called in at Freetown for fruit and veg. The bumboats came out as usual to give us fresh, you know, mangoes, bananas, whatever. He turned the steam hoses on them. But just for no reason whatsoever, clear off my ship sort of thing, don't come in. He actually, not the cold water, the hot water. And we did Cape Town to the Solent in 12 days, which must be something of a record, I'll tell you. I mean, it's in 12 days from the Solent.
What was the name of the ship?
HMS Newcastle. Then I was duly demobbed, went back to my job, and wasn't happy. I started applying for jobs, and applied to one advertising for an engineer by Balfour Beatty, who were then in London. Went down for an interview, and I saw one chap, and he said, well, before you proceed any further, you better go and see our Mr. Lott, who's in charge of East Africa, as you seem to have been around a bit, because we want people to go to East Africa as engineers. And I saw this Mr. Lott, and in no time he'd convinced me I was just the guy they were looking for. And to learn their method of working things, they gave me a month's stay with one of their gangs, with a foreman and an engineer, and how they worked the surveying in Montrose. And then I came back to head office, and it was the aircraft out to Dar es Salaam in the first instance. And
when would this have been?
That was 1949. I arrived in Dar es Salaam and dropped into the general duties, and the then general manager, who was, as a matter of interest, the general manager was a fellow called Charlie Murray, or just C.C. Murray, Mr. Charles Murray, wouldn't allow himself to be called anything except Mr. And he had been the first territorial colonel in the British Army, the first territorial to make full colonel, but he would not go to any reunions. He wouldn't allow himself to be called anything but Mr. Murray or Sir, and that was it. He wouldn't allow anybody to call him Colonel. But his wife actually told me, and it's the sort of thing you wouldn't discuss with him if he didn't want to know anything about it. His wife was very friendly, and often used to have us up for a bottle of beer or a cup of tea and discuss. She actually, I think, was the person who analysed the stuff for him, and then would report back to him on what she, because we didn't at the time realise that it was, she was listening to us talking. She was saying very little, in fact, very little indeed, and I'm sure on reflection that it all went back to Charlie Murray anyway. He said then that he didn't want me to stay in Dar es Salaam. He wanted me to get a gang together and become a construction engineer for him, as they hadn't got a construction engineer. And then I was in charge of for him to cut this side a little bit short, about six or seven stations. So first of all, I went to Iringa, where I put new overhead lines up and rewired the whole town with LV mains, new lighting, everything. Did some work on the houses with a gang. I'd got a gang of about, started off with from Dar es Salaam with a gang of five. Charlie Murray said, give Ian some of, to each engineer in Dar es Salaam, he said, there were five. He said, give him one of your best blokes, because he's got no experience of Africans. Oh, well, you know what happened, don't you? Each one gave me one of the worst. But I kept them. And with my system of working, and not treating them as dirt, which they were African natives. And I had a very good foreman who was a European, and I told him my knowledge and he taught the Africans, and they worked to my standard after that, and we got up to the British standard, which was a mile a week of 11 kV line, which was pretty good going in Africa, I say it myself. But that gang in time built up to 400 so I went to Iringa first, then they moved me on to Mbeya. Well, these towns were townships in the southern highlands of Tanganyika, and they were beautiful spots. I mean, you're looking at 5,000 feet high, log fires at night, blazing sun in the middle of the day, plenty of strawberries, fresh fruit, you name it, everything, cream, just everything. They didn't suffer from any effects of the war. When I was in Iringa, heard of Hemingway, the author.
Yes.
He lived just up the road.
Did you have any contact with him?
Oh, yes. He wasn't a socialiser either. He was a bit of a recluse, but he did come into the club occasionally and had a word or two with him. Very nice chap. And then I went to...
In what way was he a nice chap?
Very erudite gentleman. Knew his stuff, but he wasn't really socialised. He'd have a beer or two and then he'd be gone, and you wouldn't see him for months, sort of thing. But he knew his Africa, no doubt about that.
In what way?
He could speak so many dialects, which I could speak a few words of various dialects, but nothing to hold a conversation, although I was quite proficient in Bantu or Swahili. I could carry on I learnt in about 6 months to be able to think in Swahili. I mean, once you can think in a language, you've cracked it, you've got it. I can still speak it, by the way. I never forget it. I mean, a chap could walk in now and just say a few words to me and I'd be able to hold a conversation. And I think with any language, if you really learn it and live in the country for a certain length of time, you don't lose it. It's not like school, French or German or Latin or whatever, anything. That goes, it's gone. But if you live in the country, it goes in and it sticks. There's a saying about East Africa. They say that anybody that's lived in East Africa, when they leave a corner of the heart behind them. It's very, very true, because I often think of it. I went then to a place called Mbeya, which was still in the southern highlands, did much the same work. Then I went to Morogoro, and Charlie Murray said to me, sent me a telegram. He said, I was still in Mbeya at the time. And this was about, about 250 miles over shocking roads in... I got a four-wheel drive vehicle, a Canadian Ford V8, which was necessary. It was the wet season. My instructions were to be on the office door at 8 o'clock the next morning. And I was there, managed to make it, driving through the night with my good... foreman, Tom Woodruff. 8 o'clock came and went, then this woman turned up, who was a European clerk. They often used to employ husbands, the wives of husbands who were working out there as clerks for various jobs and weeks. This officer had got one. So I said, "Where's so-and-so, the engineer in charge?" She said, "Oh, he'll be along in a bit." Well, along in a bit turned out about 9:30, and I said, "Well, where does he live? I'm going after him." Went to the house, and there he was in bed, of course. So that was the sort of situation that was going on. I asked him to come back to the office with me, open the safe. The safe did not tally with the accounts that this lady had got. In other words, it was very considerably light. So I reported this to head office, and they came to the conclusion that he was an Asian, by the way, this chap. And I gave him a pretty good report regarding his work. The station was in perfect order and the lights were on, but he just was not cut out to be in charge of the station. He could make it run, so what they did, they just took him down to Dar es Salaam and put him in the main power station, and he carried on there. And from then on, Charlie Murray said, "Well, you better be my troubleshooter, and also the next station you go to," which was back to Morogoro again, back to Bear, I said, I came from, and he put me in charge of it. Now, that meant I was in charge of the station, and also had to do the rest of the line jobs in my spare time. But that wasn't too bad, because this is about 2 years on now, and I've trained my gang up. I've got about 400 from the original 5, and I could detach the head linesman and make him one gang, and Tom Woodruff would go with another, and I could get on with the office work and all the rest of it. And then I was in charge of variously a place called Tabora, which interesting enough was the old slave route for slaves from Zanzibar, who the Arabs brought them to Dar es Salaam, or just north of Dar es Salaam, a little port there, and then they marched them through Tabora, and they sell some they'd picked up on the way, and then capture a lot more and take them back and sell them to the Africans back at the port. And this exercise used to take months, you know, sort of note transport. All chained together or tied together, the Africans, terrible sort of thing. Then from Tabora, Charlie Murray decided to send me to Kigoma. Now, Kigoma was a very interesting place. It's only a small town, it's at the north end of Lake Tanganyika, but only 7 miles away from a place called Ujiji. And Ujiji is where Stanley met Livingstone. And there is a plinth there to mark that spot. On this spot, Dr. Stanley Livingstone met the whole meeting.
What date have we reached now, approximately?
We'd be into 1953 now.
What are your memories of the actual start of Mau Mau?
Well, it was around all the time. There was a lot of peculiar things on the farms. By the way, I should have said earlier, we all knew about Mau Mau because all the farmers, we didn't in towns, very few, but all the farmers carried guns. Revolvers, and the situation was so serious that if anybody left a revolver or ammunition in the car unattended, the immediate fine in front of the magistrates was £100 or 2,000 shillings, because they worked in shillings in East Africa, and that was the first offence, and the second offence, I think something very nasty happened to them. They either got their licence taken away or they were jailed. I'm talking about Europeans. Very, very serious offence to leave any arms or ammunition about, because what happened, they got stolen. And then another thing was, they had dressers, African dressers, in most of the hospitals, and they were the guys who were stealing stuff to supply the Mau Mau. Well, there was no way the hospital staff could stop them stealing stuff in a way. They could tighten it up, but they could still get away with it, because if you wanted an African dresser, you'd only have one for a small hospital. You'd have one European sister, probably a couple of Asian ward sisters, and the rest were Africans. So, I mean, they really, it was a bit difficult to stop this ammunition or whatever medical supplies getting back to the Aberdare Mountains, where the Kikuyu were based, because that was their hiding out spot. Anyway, then I was there was one interesting thing about I got moved to a place called Mwanza, which is on the shores of Lake Victoria, south end of Lake Victoria. Very, very nice spot. And an engineer prior to me had pegged the route of an overhead line through some land, and I said to Tom, I said, well, go and have a look at these pegs are here. The place was all overgrown. It's bush and everything and trees. I said, well, here's the first peg. You just follow your way through here, Tom. I've got to get back to the office. And get the gang in and chop your way through this, about half a mile. This route I wanted him to do that day. He cleared it, and then all hell broke loose the next day. They apparently, what the other engineer had done, he pegged through a Hindu cemetery. Although it was overgrown, it was still sacrosanct to the Hindus. And oh, we'd done everything. We disobeyed every Hindu rule possible. I mean, walking through it with shoes on for a start. I mean, that was a very, very big offence. I mean, in their eyes. So that was all calmed down. But it's just one of the sort of things that happened.
Could I ask you, what impression did you get about the voluntary support which the Kikuyu were giving to Mau Mau? Did you form any impression as to whether their support was voluntary or forced?
My honest impression was that it was no way voluntary, it was forced. There was a lot of, and still is, there was a lot of voodoo in East Africa, believe it or not. Forget the Barbados and places like that for a moment. You consider East Africa, it was and still is full of voodoo, and the witch doctors would instruct these guys to obey, and so they were coerced into helping. This is how it happened. I'm sure these chaps in the hospital were never stolen voluntarily. They were forced to do it on pain of what might happen to the relatives or themselves. In fact, I had, interestingly enough, one of my own gang, who I had quite a few Kikuyus, because I had a mixed gang of all races, so it was the best way to split them up, and then they couldn't get up to mischief. So they were all right, but this one guy said he was going to die. I had a very good friend, the local European hospital, I'm going to say hospital manager, the local doctor, medical officer in charge of Tanganyika at the time. And I said, well, yeah, I'd have a look at this bloke, Richie. He says, yeah, wheel him along to the hospital. And he went over him and he said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this guy. He said, nothing. So he got the story out of him that the witch doctor had told him he'd die if he didn't do so and so to help the Kikuyu. And he actually died. No, there's no question about that. The guy died with nothing wrong with him.
When you say to help the Kikuyu, you mean to help Mau Mau?
Yes.
Or
when I say Kikuyu in this sense, I'm referring to the Mau Mau, yes.
Did you know what they wanted him to do?
Couldn't get that out of him. Probably wanted some implements. We carried a lot of axes, tools, of that knives, cutting the bush, so something of that order.
What, do you remember his name?
well, they're all son of. He was Simon, son of somebody, but I forget his name now. I lost a lot of my logs. So I used to keep a log there all the time. But anyway, that is true. Then he sent me, Charlie Murray sent me to a place called Moshi. Now Moshi is just on the borders of Kenya. You're heading on to Mount Meru, which is quite a high mountain, and the Aberdares, and as I say, this was the local place. And I did some jobs there, and then he sent me back in charge of Arusha, which is only about 20 miles away, still in the same area, on the borders, more or less, Kenya, Tanganyika. And this is where it was really hot. There was a lot of raids there, and there were some rather nasty things happening as well. They would raid a farm, the Mau Mau, and they would cut off a man's genitals and stuff them down his wife's throat. This is fact. This is all on record. And rip a woman's belly up with a knife if she was pregnant, kill children. But not only did they do it to the Europeans, they did it to their own as well. And it is on record that the Mau Mau actually killed more of their own people than they did Europeans. I suppose there were more Africans about, put it that way. But the one good story that I can tell you about this, which is very, very true, there is one tribe in Africa who are frightened of no man. In fact, they consider themselves as the god of all races, and that is the famous Maasai. Now, they will bow to nobody. It doesn't matter who they are, they don't recognise a European as a provincial commissioner. Don't ask me his name, I've forgotten it. I know Sir Edward Twining was the governor of Dar es Salaam at the time. That's all I can remember, because I went to several of his parties as engineer in charge of these various branches. Every time there was a thing at Government House or a provincial commissioner was holding a do, or in a smaller place, a district commissioner, I was invited as warranted my sort of rating in the township, because they very, very closely, you know, the wives all kept a list of who was in charge of what, and you automatically got invited to these things. They could be quite boring at times. Other times they were quite interesting, you know, just depended. But anyway, that was the sort of thing.
You were going to tell me about the Maasai in Arusha.
In Arusha, this provincial commissioner, they were getting very, very naughty. They were coming through the mountains, and they were raiding cattle, and they were doing a lot of damage. They were killing people. And he called me to his office one day, and he said, where are you working, what area? And I told him. He said, well, keep all your men out of a certain area, which was about 5 miles from Arusha, because he said, I don't want anybody there at the time. Nobody. Not you, not the your gang or anybody. Oh, certainly, sir, yes, will do, no problem. Go somewhere else. Went the other end of town. And what transpired afterwards, this is what he'd done, and it's very, very true. I doubt you'd find it in any history books, because it was the sort of thing that would be strictly verboten. He got hold of the local Maasai chief. Now, how he bribed him to do it, I don't know, because normally, as I say, they wouldn't answer to anybody. They wouldn't answer to the king or the queen. They were a law unto themselves. And this would be now 1954. It was 54-55. There's no question about that here, because I can, without recompense to any notes, I can follow my career from town to town pretty well, and 6 months here, a year there, and I know I was in Arusha at that time. It'd be the autumn of 44, beginning of 45, spring.
54.
Not back in the Navy now, we're there. 54. Right. So he got this chief and all his tribesmen, and they went on the rampage and they massacred every single Mau Mau in the area. Literally.
Every Mau Mau?
Every Mau Mau.
Or Kikuyu?
Well, every Kikuyu that was a member of the Mau Mau. In other words, they attacked all the Kikuyus who were obviously... all Kikuyus were members of the Mau Mau. That was the tribe. The Mau Mau were only composed of Kikuyu and no other tribe. So if I say the Kikuyu, are actually, in that context, I mean the Mau Mau. They did the lot, and I'm told they killed thousands. This all trickled back because it soon became the talk of the clubs and the, you know, and that sort of thing. But whether that was ever written up in his autobiography or not, I don't know. But it's very, very true. And then these Mau Mau, they were seen around the town, of course. You know, sort of very strange to see Mau Mau because they to see Maasai in a town, because they're bush people. They live off the cattle. They drink the milk and the blood. That is their diet. They don't eat anything else. Perhaps some corn or, you know, maize, stuff like that. But their basic diet is they have the cattle and they live off the blood and the milk, plus the corn. So to see them in town was a little bit odd, but nobody thought anything of it. But that's what happened. The provincial commissioner... How he bribed them to do it, I do not know.
Right. I think you've got a little story that you can recount about the fear that the other tribes in East Africa had for the Maasai.
Yes, it's quite a funny one, actually. We through the railways out there were mostly inefficient, single line, and a lot of holds up. And if I wanted any supplies urgently, I used to go personally and collect them at the railhead at a place called Dodoma, which was as far as the rail went. After that it was roads north. And going down on one of the trips, there was a party of Africans waiting beside the road, shouting and wanting a lift. So I pulled up, and these guys got on, and I said everything all right. And Tom Woodruff, my foreman, who was with me, said, Mr. Fraser, he said, where's the gang? And I looked through the rear window, and there's not a single soul on board. They've all jumped off, and these Maasai are sitting there with the spears and the shields, sitting there very comfortably, having taken over the truck. And I said, what's this then, Tommy? Well, he said, they're Maasai, our lot aren't, and you won't get our lot back before you get rid of the Maasai. I said, well, how do I get rid of the Maasai? Well, he said, that's your business, Mr. Fraser, and he said, you're going to have a job on, first of all, to get rid of them, because once they're on, they won't get off. So I'd had a little bit of experience of African ways, so I asked who the head man was of this little party. There'd be about a dozen of them, looking very, very fierce in all the red clay war paint and all the rest. They dress themselves up normally. Anyway, the hair all red with the murram and plaited. Because they are a warrior tribe. Anyway, I asked for the chief chap, and I thought, well, there's only one thing to do here. And I said, knowing what they lived on, I said to him, look, if you get off,